WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. I'm Jason Mann, and we are continuing our SummerSlam main event series. And today my guest is Thomas Holzerman. TH, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm doing well. So we are talking about the main event of SummerSlam 2001. It is the WCW champion Booker T defending that title against The Rock. And that's just kind of a weird thing to say, the WCW title being defended in a match with The Rock.
And it was weird because the other title match on the card was between Stone Cold Steve Austin and Kurt Angle. And you would think that with Austin being the head of the Resistance, I mean, not the Resistance, the Alliance, and Angle having come into his own, you would probably argue that with Booker T coming into prominence in WCW when it was going down the toilet, you would think that Angle might have a bigger, like, name cachet. But at the same time, Austin retained his title, so maybe they didn't want to send the crowd home unhappy.
Yeah, that seems likely to me. And obviously they would, in the next few months, the Angle-Austin feud would be really the prominent feud, and Rock-Booker T would sort of be the secondary feud. But it got its moment in the sun here. So not to go through the entire invasion because there's so much and it was very, very convoluted and confusing, but much of it. Yeah. Some of it was actually pretty awesome. Like it varied very highly week to week at that point. But, the basic gist of it was Booker came over from WCW. Of course, WCW, was sold to WWE in March of, 2001. And they took a few months to kind of figure out what they were going to do with it. There was talk of a separate TV show, and that didn't pan out. So basically, Booker kickstarted they'd already had, I think, Lance Storm super kicked somebody a few weeks before. But one of the first big WCW angles was at King of the Ring 2001. Booker came out of the crowd. He gave Austin the bookend through a table, I believe, and then scurried away. Which was sort of a strange debut because WCW at the time were sort of the good guys. And Austin, given that he was the bad guy, but it was just sort of like even though it was against Austin, the bad guy, it was still kind of a cheap move to do. But anyway, it didn't really take with WCW being the good guys, and they all pretty much turned pretty quickly, and Booker T being chief among them as WCW champion. And then basically Rock came back from his hiatus. He'd in storyline, he'd been suspended the day after WrestleMania. In real life, he had filmed, I think, The Scorpion King, or a major movie, prior to The Scorpion King. So so he was doing that, and then he came back, and they kind of played up him, whether he would choose WCW or WWF. They had a segment with him and Shane and Vince, Shane being the owner of WCW. And then he actually rock bottomed Vince first with the brief swerve of thinking he had joined WCW. But of course he then beat up Shane and then chose the good guys. And then Booker took a little bit of exception to that. They kind of went back and forth and so forth, and then set up this match.
Yeah. And, it was sort of a weird match in a way that you had the guy when WCW was circling the drain was being pushed as a Rocky clone.
In some ways, yes. I mean, they emphasized that more at times than other times. Like summer 2000, I think they really pushed that, and then they kind of toned back on it through the rest of his run. But then they obviously emphasized it very much again during this feud, which really, I think, made him look second rate. Like, I got the idea that they were trying to show in theory that like Booker was just as good as Rock and in doing these things and kind of was that parallel, but kind of in every, by trying to be too much like Rock, he paled in comparison and looked pretty bad for the most part.
Yeah. I think it came through in the match as well. I would be jumping around by saying this, but Heyman, who was part of the Alliance and had, at this point was replacing Jerry Lawler as the color commentator, he would basically keep using The Rock's catchphrases and his descriptions to describe Booker. And where I think you're correct in the cheapness of it all, where he would describe the Spinneroonie as the most electrifying move in all of sports entertainment. Whereas, I mean, at least The Rock's people's elbow, that was an impact move. He actually hit somebody. Spinneroonie was just sort of like a fancy kip-up.
That's true. I did like the line by Ross that if the WWF gets wiped out by the Spinneroonie, then by God, we deserve to get wiped out. So at least it did lead to that. I did so enjoy some of those exchanges by Ross and Heyman. I enjoyed the chemistry that they had, and they did a nice job where they were clearly, you know, they were enemies for a purpose, because, you know, this angle was, of course, WCW and ECW joining together to wipe out WWF. And so the arguing that they would sometimes do completely made sense in that context, because they were, I mean, literally kind of fighting for their livelihoods. So
it was a refreshing change, because there hadn't really been a true adversarial pairing in the booth since the actual Attitude Era. Lawler slowly morphed from sort of a prick heel into JR's almost buddy when he would turn from the, like, he would be the guy who would always cheer on the heels to the guy who always cheered on the person with the biggest breasts. It was a good dynamic. Even then, the calls for Lawler right now to be put out the pasture are deafening, but then they were happening. But at the same time, him and Ross still had a very good chemistry together, and Lawler still generally gave a crap.
Yeah. Well,
Heyman coming in, and he was totally brought the total adversarial nature back to the broadcast booth. And that was refreshing.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing was they didn't overdo it, though. Like, I sometimes listening to some commentary today, you feel like you're listening to, like, a married couple argue for 2 hours. Where here, I mean, they certainly made their points and they certainly had their things, but it wasn't like it lingered and it wasn't like it made it, you feel like they weren't talking about what was going on.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's one of the biggest problems today with Michael Cole's new character. He just bickers, especially with Josh Matthews and Booker T, just for the sake of bickering, and it doesn't get the product over. And you have guys like Jim Ross and Paul Heyman, both guys astute minds for the business, and they bickered, but it got the narrative over.
Yeah, I agree. So Shane McMahon makes his presence very prominently felt during this match, which I'm not a big Shane McMahon fan. I know others are, but myself, not really into Shane McMahon, and also I've noticed that Shane tends to not make good decisions when he like manages somebody. Like they always seem to lose. Like he chose like the Big Show at WrestleMania 2000, and that was kind of a disaster. You know, he chose Booker here, and Booker did not do well. You know, he chose WCW in general, which was not a good choice for him. It just seems like he always kind of picks the wrong man. In fact, I'm not sure. He might have had less success as a manager than even Slick.
Yeah. Shane McMahon was a better wrestler than he was a manager.
No, that's not true. I'm not gonna go that far.
Well, I'm not talking about.
You mean more successful as a wrestler than a manager?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I meant. More successful. He was a far better manager in terms of looking at things critically. I really enjoyed Shane McMahon in this match. He was really the do-everything manager, and he really got into his role of helping, doing anything he could to help the cause. Whereas, you know, Bobby Heenan would take a bump here and there, and he was a great manager. I'm not denigrating Bobby Heenan, but he was an older guy, so he couldn't do the thing Shane McMahon could do as a 20-something, very mobile, very agile type person. And I think that really enhanced things here because he was a guy who was willing to go all in. It was kind of an endearing quality, which sort of belied his role as the top villain in the company. He would go all in. He would do everything to protect his investment, whereas his father, he'd sit in his office and...
I see where you're going with that, Shane just annoys me to the point where it's so obnoxious that I can't stand him. And two, I thought it was a little too much. Like, I thought I was just kind of more into the match, and then I kind of felt like I understand the role that Shane played, and I respect that storytelling, but it just it didn't quite click for me. But I get where it makes sense on the surface in any case. So
yeah, I can understand where someone might not dig it because they kind of want the match to show through, and I thought the match did a good job of doing that, even with Shane's rampant interference.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I will take Shane McMahon as a meddling manager than as the Shane McMahon who runs out and makes Randy Orton sell for him when his punches are like 5 inches away from his face.
Yes, I will definitely agree with you there. Shane does do one very cool thing in this match, which we'll get into. But so we kind of start off with Rock chasing Shane into the ring. Booker takes him down briefly, but then Rock is able to whip Booker into Shane, knocking him off the apron, and gets a Samoan drop for two. And pretty fast, furious pace early, very back and forth. Booker reverses an Irish whip, gets a knee to the belly, chops in the corner. Then Rock reverses into some of his punches, but Booker gets a thumb to the eye. Then Rock gets a clothesline and follows with an Oklahoma roll of all things, which I don't recall ever seeing him do before or after. I'm sure he probably did, but that was a pretty good move.
I had noted that too, and I just thought this is the sort of carrot for the people who, like me, who see Rocky as more than just the guy who came out and talked about Strudel.
Yeah.
By this time, he had become one of the finest wrestlers in the company, not just performers, but actually an in-ring worker. And people just couldn't take that. I mean, I could see maybe in his early days where people might have said he was too green and. But I think a lot of the criticism for Rock had come down to, oh, he didn't do enough moves, which always baffles me when someone criticizes a WWE wrestler for not doing enough moves. Even guys like Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero, and even now Daniel Bryan, guys who are reputed to be great wrestlers, and who were great wrestlers, and in the WWE, they don't do moves, and there's a reason for that. In the WWE, you're not called upon to do to shove 20 moves in 2 minutes. You're called upon mostly to tell a story. And to me, Rock was great at doing that, especially later on as he got the business and got the actual having the mechanics of how to work a good match down pat.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that with the right opponent. I mean, and Rock could certainly even have good matches with lesser opponents, but it was definitely like, I think the one flaw I would say with Rock is some of the execution on the moves was a little bit suspect. His sharpshooter always looked a little bit ugly. He had like kind of a belly to belly throw that was sort of, you know, like I guess it's some of the same things that people say with Cena. And I don't agree at all that Cena is not a good worker because I think he is and he has good matches. But I do think that there is some like sloppy execution stuff that he sometimes does. There are a little bit infuriating things that he does with selling. And I think Rock, although he was very good and had wonderful matches, I think does have some of those flaws that separate him from, you know, that he doesn't have quite the same level of execution sometimes.
I could see that a little bit. The sharpshooter always got me, and it still is a sticking point to a lot of fans, lapsed or not. I've seen on Twitter one guy who wasn't a fan and has come back recently thanks to The Rock and then now CM Punk coming back, was watching the Cena Rey Mysterio match, and when Rey Mysterio put Cena in the STF, he remarked that it still didn't look as bad as when Rock put people in the sharpshooter.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say Rock didn't execute a lot of his moves. I mean, the difference with Rock and Cena, I think Cena, Rock did execute a lot of his moves, maybe different, but aside from the sharpshooter, I don't recall a lot of them looking terrible or really all that different. With Cena, it's not that I think his moves look bad, it's just he takes a lot of moves and sort of dumbs them down to a point where they're overly simplistic looking.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, there's the fisherman suplex that he hooks the leg momentarily and then just ends up looking like a regular suplex. There's the Blue Thunder Bomb, or the Proto Bomb, where it just ends up looking more like a side slam. He even does a move that looks almost like Emerald Flosion, which is the over-the-shoulder pile driver made famous by Mitsuharu Misawa and done by Rikishi in the WWE when he was there. But it looks like it starts out as like that over-the-shoulder pile driver. It ends up more like another side slam. So it's like he does advanced moveset for dummies at times. I never get that feeling with Rock, but yeah, I will cop the sharpshooter being terrible.
Okay, that's fair. I'm not trying to blast Rock. I'm just sort of... I think Rock like was really entertaining and had, you know, and could do his match really well, but I do think there were some little things that always kind of got me with Rock, and shared those. But anyway, so after the Oklahoma Roll, Booker gets a leg lariat, and then Rock sends Booker over the top rope. Then as we're outside, Rock slams Booker's face repeatedly on the table. And Booker is on the table, and Rock, gets the good old punch to the balls that he, enjoyed to doing. And this is a great commentary moment where JR pretends not to realize it's a low blow. And then Heyman goes crazy screaming, "Yes, it was a low blow," which I thought was a very funny moment. Although, amusingly, Booker apparently has balls of steel, because he is basically immediately able to get up and cuts Rock off with a knee lift and lifts him onto the rail. So
yeah, I noted that as well. Usually you can count on good old JR to be objective, but I thought the taking sides here worked, because, again, the adversarial nature in the broadcast booth. And really, you could tell JR was a guy who enjoyed working for the WWF at the time. I guess it was sort of like maybe accidental storytelling, or maybe it wasn't accidental, it was subtle, where they would play up where you had the two sides going, and JR was rooting for the WWE, and Heyman was rooting for the Alliance, and there was sort of that undercurrent where JR used to be a WCW employee, and there was just this undercurrent that maybe he didn't enjoy his time there, so maybe that's why he was rooting so hard for his current place of employment.
Mm-hmm. He would bring that up from time to time. You know, he hinted at it anyway.
And he was always great at just calling the action, but I think here he definitely kicked it up a notch in just sort of playing a role as the voice of the company, whereas Heyman was the voice of the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I also got a kick out of Ross mentioning Charles Robinson by name, which never happens today. And just it's sort of a contrast of the eras.
Yeah.
Where referees now are sort of faceless and nameless, but back then they were faceless, but at least they had names.
Yeah, that's true. Although I have noticed in older commentary that they will refer to the referee an awful lot, and they will use the names much more rarely than you would think, like given that like even times when you would think it would be appropriate to use the name, they will say the referee. So that may have been, at least not using the referee's names often might have always been a WWE thing. But yeah, as far as the out and out ban, you know, so to speak, on it, that feels like a newer phenomenon. I guess it's been a few years now since that was like a real big thing, but yes, it is nice to it's nice to know the referee's names. And Charles Robinson deserves props. He's a little Nate after all. So
he is.
Yeah.
He's getting married this weekend too.
Oh really? Huh. Yeah. Is he trying to break Ric Flair's record, or he's trying to be Ric Flair. So. So there's brawling in the crowd. Booker nails Rock out there with a hard clothesline and gets dropped into a wall. I liked here where Ross is trying to explain, like, the ref is giving them both leeway and wants a title change, and or well, doesn't want title change necessarily, but wants a wants like a good decision, you know, wants a pinfall or submission, doesn't want a count out or DQ, and then mentions the DQ in the previous match. But to be fair, the Austin Angle thing, like that was a DQ after like a lot of extraordinary, you know, there were like three ref bumps and it was like a crazy kind of random situation. It wasn't like a cheap DQ and then we're going back to this match and then we're you know, and then we're having all this mayhem and not calling a DQ. So at least it felt fairly consistency, even if JR had to kind of stretch a little bit to explain that. But at least I at least appreciate the effort in him doing that.
I like when they sort of throw out the count outs, when you have the ref trying to get a good decision, and especially in a main event match. I was actually listening to the Luger Yokozuna podcast. We're driving up to Chikara yesterday, which is apropos because that Chikara was rehashing the Lex Express in a way.
Ah.
For that weekend. But just listening to you and Bill talk about how SummerSlam 94 was littered with DQ and countout finishes, you expect those kind of finishes to be on your TV shows, but not on like the stuff you're paying for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at this point, they did a good job. A similar match that I recall with this that sort of vibe, although it was the product of a ref bump and not exactly of the ref actively trying to get them in the ring for that 1-2-3 finish, and that was Triple H versus Undertaker at WrestleMania X7, which was 4 months prior.
Mm-hmm.
It featured Trips and Taker just battling into the crowd and just tearing each other down, and it added a lot to the match because they were going wild, and it was sort of, it fit in the narrative of that feud. Mm-hmm. Also far better than the WrestleMania 27 match, but that's a whole other podcast. I like that the ref took the active role, and I'm not sure whether it was intentional or not, but with Robinson being an Alliance referee, it might have been in his best interest if he was biased to let them brawl because Booker would have kept the title on the double countout.
Yeah, they were good about like keeping the referee. Like they didn't do any biased referee angles, I don't think, during the Alliance during the Invasion period. Was Nick Patrick ever a biased referee during? Because they obviously did that a lot in WCW. I can't remember if they rehashed that in WWE or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. We all know that he was the biased referee, maybe because of his NWO status, and they really overdid that. It was one of the big things why the NWO sort of ran aground, because Nick Patrick was often used as deus ex machina to keep the NWO having its dominance.
Okay, he had a match. Okay, I guess he did play a little bit of a heel referee during the Alliance time. He refused to count in the Rock Booker T Shane McMahon match, the rematch from this at Unforgiven 2001. So I guess he did do a little bit of that. And he and Earl Hebner had a match during the Invasion, which I completely forgot about. So, all right, well.
I would blame you.
Yeah. So anyway, back to the match. We have Booker tosses Rock over the Raw into ringside. He takes off the top of the table, and Rock gets a bit of a moment of hope here with some punches, but then gets sent back first into the post. Works him over some more outside. They go into the ring for a two count, hits a short arm clothesline and a knee drop. Then he does sort of a dramatic pose, he's sort of teasing the Spinneroonie, though he does not actually do it here. Ross makes fun of the Spinneroonie name, wondering what idiot came up with that name. Specifically, which is funny because, of course, Mark Madden was the one who came up with that name. So, he seemed like an idiot for the most part. So, Rock is able to avoid a move, but then Booker bounces off the ropes. It's a really nice flying forearm. I always enjoyed Booker T's flying forearm. One of his better moves for sure.
Yeah.
And we get a little bit of a break with a chin lock, and this gives Ross and Heyman time to debate exactly who and what and how is most electrifying, which is just a strange debate to have during a wrestling match. I know, like, one of the things in wrestling that sort of bothers me is, like, the fact that they bring up, like, such and such is more entertaining, such and such is boring, such and such is electrifying, such and such has charisma. Like, I just think, like, the idea of, like, I know the importance of charisma as far as a performer goes, but that they actually, like, acknowledge that on the television show has always been a strange phenomenon to me. Like, just, I don't know, that they bring that up is just so very weird.
I actually got into a debate with a fellow Twitter user, Stephen Stone of Raffle Kingdom, when he was talking about being annoyed at Cole using that whole boring talking point in regards to Daniel Bryan, saying he's burying Daniel Bryan when... and I can see where you're coming from on stuff like this, but I thought, at least in that spot, that Cole was doing Daniel Bryan a favor and trying to curry favor. It's a whole storyline thing. In a way, I can agree with you, though, because... Yeah, you hardly ever see sport commentators resorting to that kind of conversation. But and wrestling is always good when it's a sort of like a perfect mix of sport and entertainment. You never really want to deny that wrestling has at least a facade of being a sport. However, the announcers in sport never really are characters, whereas in wrestling, they're characters in the almost agents of action far more often than you'll ever find in pro sport. And when it happens in sport, like when Joe Buck went off on Randy Moss for pretending to pull his pants down, it's greeted with groans, whereas in wrestling you get stuff like Jerry Lawler feuding with The Miz, which was generally well regarded by most people who didn't have sticks up their butts. So I guess I'm sort of conflicted about it. The talk about it being electrifying didn't really bother me.
Yeah, it didn't bother me here. I mean, it was fine and kind of a funny debate, but I do think that in general, like, it can be, like, even the Daniel Bryan thing, I thought it was fine when they were feuding. I think it's kind of silly now. I guess I don't mind him not liking Daniel Bryan or making fun of Daniel Bryan, but I guess, like, the being the boring, like, the nerd thing's okay. But, you know, the fact that he's boring and lacks charisma, when that's just, like, that just seems like a silly thing to bring up on a show, where as opposed to, like, oh, he's a nerd, oh, he loses, you know, here, oh, he's not good enough, that's fine because Bryan can overcome that, you know. And there's different ways of doing it, I guess, and it's one of those, like, you know it when you see it type things, maybe.
I guess so. But I still think the person saying it, if Cole were still the voice of the WWE in terms of being the babyface, I could see where that would be terrible,
yeah,
and just sort of a pseudo burial. But he's the heel, so he's supposed to say things like that. I don't know.
It's just a matter of doing it right and doing it wrong. And I'm not saying Cole does it wrong, but I don't think he always does it right, I guess is my thing on that. But So we have, after the chin lock, Rock breaks out of it. He gets the double leg takedown and into the sharpshooter, which the crowd picks up quite a bit on that. Although the crowd was into this whole match. It wasn't like they were dead for anything. Shane does pop up on the apron. Rock breaks it. Then Rock drags Shane in. And then out of nowhere, Booker hits a really cool super kick for two. So we have another he was very crisp on his execution of moves in this match for the most part, which I Booker's a good worker, you know. He really developed later in his career and really got smart about, he always obviously had the athletic gifts, but he improved a lot in the late 90s when he became a singles wrestler, but he really even, knocked it up a notch, and then of course character wise really clicked, I think, in the late 2000s. But then Rock hits a short clothesline, but ends up catapulted into the turnbuckle that was exposed. They made a point earlier that Shane was trying to loosen it up, and apparently the turnbuckle pad at some point fell. And then gets a DDT. Shane slides a chair into the ring and grabs the WCW belt. Booker crawls to the chair while Charles Robinson moves it. And then from behind, Shane nails Rock with a belt for two, which it was, I admittedly, a pretty creative spot.
Yeah, that to me was one of the most brilliant bits of psychology in the match. It's that sort of thing. It really makes a match pop, where it can get a heel over really well if he wins, because he did it really dastardly but in a real clever sort of manner, and it sort of gives the face that much more of a boost when he overcomes it. I just love it. It was done so sneakily well, and I just love the heel trickery.
Yeah,
it's one of the big things why I like good technical wrestling, but it's why I can get into stuff where, again, Bobby Heenan was really good at this. Other managers were really good at this. I'm blanking at the moment. But going back to what you said about Booker T turning into a fine worker, I think he sort of evolved in almost like the most common way. He started out as a tag wrestler, and he had deficiencies, but they were able to be hidden within the tag match. I'm not saying Stevie Ray was the better worker, because he was dog poop, never really evolved. But they were able to hide each other's deficiencies, and then when Booker sort of smoothed out, he was able to break into the singles ranks, and he kept improving to the point where he became one of the best workers in any major company.
Definitely, yeah. He did certainly. The evolution of Booker is very interesting, and then I think especially with the character work. I mean, really, how he kind of came out of nowhere with the King Booker thing, and how wonderfully silly and fun that was pretty interesting. I always enjoy like those late in career type things where a guy kind of catches fire with something completely out of nowhere, sort of toward the end of his in ring career. So,
it's really like Booker was doing badly, because he had the whole book dust thing, and even here, as the sort of like the captain, one of the co-captains of the Alliance, it was always his facial expressions and everything he did without really saying a word, even though he was fairly good in getting the spoken word over. I mean, his facial expressions, his body language, it was all so brilliant. I think that was maybe the best part of Booker T, really, in any incarnation, just the way he reacted to things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Booker was great even now. I just mean, I don't know. I thought he just clicked so perfectly and had so much confidence, and he was good here, but it just never felt quite like I said, he kind of felt like the character at this point was sort of in the shadow of the Rock. And yeah, he definitely slowly moved out of that and found himself again and found his own thing. And yeah, and had some really fun things, but I just kind of think it was like a sort of a slow peak, and there were some valleys there in the 03, 04, 05 ish time, you know, that the tag team with Rob Van Dam for a while or whatever, you know, he just was kind of
stood by Triple H.
Yeah, just was kind of like, you know, sort of stuck in some things where it was just kind of humdrum, but, you know, but really, you know, later on really, really gelled and is, you know, ever since then has pretty much been marvelous as a character, at least as far as I'm concerned. Now, I didn't see a whole lot of his TNA stuff, which apparently was not well regarded after a while, but, you know. I'm not going to subject myself to that if I don't have to. So
that with TNA, especially the era between when Kurt Angle debuted and now, really TNA is a way of bringing people down. But that has, I think that's more to do not with actual, you know, transforming when you go into the impact zone more or less, but more of a transformation when you're under the constant chaos of having too many cooks in the kitchen. And one of those cooks being Vince Russo.
well said. So after, of course, all these shenanigans by Shane, the APA, Bradshaw and Farouk come out to chase him. And Shane scurries around the ring being chased by Farouk and then runs into a really, he always did it hard, but a really hard clothesline from hell from Bradshaw. And Shane does take a marvelous bump on it. I have to give him credit for that. He did he sold it well, and basically he is almost dead, not completely dead, but almost dead after that. And the ref then sends the APA back, which is an important detail, as we will see in a moment.
It's also in event continuity, because Shane ends up costing the APA their match against Test and the Dudley Boys.
That's right, yeah.
So it's a nice bit of sort of in-event storytelling, sort of a good self-contained narrative, which I think any good event, it isn't just a continuation of a story, but it's a story within itself.
So we have Booker gets the bookend, but he's sort of slow to cover and only gets two. Then Rock makes a comeback after blocking Booker's punches, hits a big flurry. He lands a flying clothesline and a belly-to-belly for two. Booker tries the axe kick, but then Rock hits the people's elbow, goes for the people's elbow, but Shane flies in to interrupt it. Rock hits the rock bottom on Shane outside, back in, and Rock punches him in the corner. Booker counters into a spine buster there, and then Booker slowly gets up. He is able to hit the axe kick, and then goes for the spinneroonie, which is mostly booed. Oh, there were a couple of cheers for it. It's just weird for the spinneroonie to be a thing that is booed. That was only a brief time, but it's hard to wrap my mind around that. Anyway, I like this finish because, yeah, it's him sort of being cocky and hitting the spinneroonie, and then Rock suddenly kips up and hits the rock bottom for the win, and that's it, and he's the WCW champion. So that got a really big reaction at the end. Was a pretty fun finish, I think. Just sort of enjoyable, nice, sort of tied into the whole thing of Booker trying to be the guy who tries to show up Rock with his, you know, sports entertainment-y stuff, and then Rock's able to, you know, counter that and win the match. So, you know, kind of being the more serious guy. So that was kind of cool, I thought.
Yeah. It was definitely one of the better SummerSlam main events in history. I'd actually forgotten that it had headline wrestling, not WrestleMania, but SummerSlam. That whole year had sort of been a blur to me.
Yeah, a lot of things happened that year.
I mean, it's sort of, the whole invasion was just so, I don't know, I guess it was so busy, you know, on top of being so poorly handled as just a sort of a way of Vince McMahon to piss on the grave of WCW. But also, I was very much into what was happening with the two-man power trip, and then the sort of challenge coming up from the two Chris's, Chris Jericho and Chris, the guy we don't mention anymore.
Yeah.
And that sort of did get derailed when Triple H tore his quad, but that sort of also led into more ramping up the WCW stuff and King of the Ring was the event where all that was supposed to happen. It was supposed to be, I guess, Jericho versus Triple H and Benoit versus Austin, or maybe it was the other way around, but it turned out being a three-way, and that sort of stalled. And then you got in the WCW stuff with Diamond Dallas Page stalking The Undertaker and Booker running in and giving the bookend to Austin at King of the Ring, and Jericho and Benoit sort of getting re-lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
I don't know. That the whole year was weird.
Yeah, yeah.
Austin turned, and he turned twice that year, actually, because he turned at WrestleMania,
mm-hmm.
and then he turned to join the Alliance after he had sort of been sort of forced back into the good guy fold.
Yeah, which was awesome, that angle where he comes and saves everybody, and then the five of them are standing in the ring. The five WWE guys, I think it's Kane, Undertaker, Jericho, I forget who the fifth one was, but I think it was Angle. Yeah, Benoit was hurt, so it was Angle, because Benoit had the neck injury by then.
And just everything, they tried so hard to make Austin a bad guy, and it didn't work.
Yeah, I mean, he was awesome at it, but it didn't click right with it. It was just never the right dynamic.
It was never the right dynamic with the fans. The fans didn't want to boo Austin. Personally, I was at the point where I didn't really care who was good, who was bad. I just wanted to be entertained. It's sort of my default state right now.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to be entertained. It's the same thing with, to a much lesser extent, because, of course, it's TNA. But when Jeff Hardy turned heel, it tanked in terms of business, and no one really wanted to boo Jeff Hardy outside the Impact Zone, but they're lemmings anyway. They'll do whatever TNA tells them to do. But critically, he played the role very, very well.
Yeah.
So, what's the matter of you're turning guys heel who don't necessarily need to be heel in terms of crowd reactions?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Austin would end the year back as a good guy, and Jericho would be the guy to take both him and Rock out.
Mm-hmm.
And we all thought, Jericho's arrived, but little do we know he turned to a Cooper Scooper.
Well, yeah, we did have the. It was interesting how when they brought the Rock back, you know, obviously the big thing was the Austin had turned on him. And taking him out. And then we eventually got our Rock Austin revenge sort of at the Survivor Series of that year when, Rock pinned Austin to, Team WWE won and then the Alliance team lost. But that was pretty much reset the next night anyway when they made Austin again into a good guy. It was just sort of like they set up so many things in 2001 that they were not able to successfully pay off, either from some of it was injuries, some of it was plans changed, some of it was incompetence, some of it was there were a lot of reasons, but it just seems like that was a year of throwing everything onto the wall and seeing what sticks kind of deal.
Yeah, and at the same time, they still didn't throw a lot of the right stuff on there. And some of it was just circumstance. I mean, there's no excuse for them turning that DDP into a sex pervert.
Actually, you know what? I thought that was okay. Like, I didn't really think, I didn't take the sex pervert thing seriously. I just kind of thought he was getting in the Undertaker's head kind of deal. I actually liked the stalker vignettes and thought that was a cool way to debut DDP. Now the feud didn't go well, but that was just kind of a weird, like, we're not going to ever let a WCW guy get too much heat on a WWE guy, especially the Undertaker. So, and maybe DDP being, kind of a guy who rubs people the wrong way sometimes.
Definitely. But some of the stuff wasn't their fault. I mean, unless you want to say that, Triple H tore his quad on purpose. Anyway, Triple H didn't tear his quad on purpose, unless you're a mega conspiracy theory. But I think there, that might have been the hook. That would have allowed WCW to sort of segue in without having to be, because really they didn't get Rick Stein, they didn't get Scott Steiner right away. Mm-hmm. They didn't get Goldberg right away. They didn't get the NWO right away. They never got Jarrett, but thank God for that. They never got Sting. They didn't get Ric Flair right away. So basically, they were running on the skeleton crew. I mean, Booker T was great, but and DDP was good. I mean, I was never the biggest DDP fan, but I mean, when those two guys are the two biggest names out of a pool of potentially Hogan, Nash, Hall, Goldberg, Steiner, you're not really playing with a full deck. And I think that if they were allowed to come in and be integrated as sort of maybe as different factions, then maybe it might have worked better. Triple H and Austin versus Benoit and Jericho as the top feud. But it didn't, and there's just a whole bunch of circumstance that came in and sort of, it was the perfect storm of crap.
Yeah, it was sort of a strange. I think 2001 was kind of the time when I sort of got a little burned out on watching wrestling, at least as often as I was. I mean, I've followed it since then and been a fan and watched it regularly since then. But I think that was sort of the year where it was like, maybe it's time for me to, lessen my focus on this a little bit. I was coming out of college as well and, becoming an adult and so forth. So there were other reasons as well, but... Yeah, 2001 was kind of a year. I wouldn't say it killed my interest, but it definitely lessened my interest. Wrestling was less fun in 2001 than it had been in a long time. And there were still individual things that were brilliant and were really fun. But overall, I mean, some of it certainly was WCW and ECW dying and the wrestling landscape feeling like it was contracting so much. And, obviously the WWE-WCW feud initially was really exciting and seemed like it was going to be a really fun thing. And, but obviously they just had no idea how to execute, or they were just unwilling to take the steps they needed to make it into a really good thing, which would have required them to, bring in some contracts that they didn't necessarily want to bring in, that most of them ended up, most of the guys they ended up bringing in later anyway, and also, putting some of those guys over their established guys to start off with. So, but it would, would have been tricky anyway. I mean, the invasion angles are generally, there's a lot, especially when you're talking about like a one on like a massive scale, as opposed to like a Randy Savage invading, Jerry Lawler's territory in 1983. That's a smaller scale one. That's one's easier to book. When you're having entire rosters and entire crews feuding with each other, that becomes that becomes more tricky.
Yeah, I think the size of the invasion is sort of inversely proportional to the success of the invasion, because remember, the NWO was really good when it was small.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it bloated, it sort of became the death of WCW. The invasion, being huge and bloated from jump, sort of doomed it. And you see the gold standard being the ICW invasion of Mid-South. That was really just like Randy Savage and his brother,
mm-hmm.
if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
It's two guys invading, and when that happens, especially when you got a guy as talented as Randy Savage,
mm-hmm.
It's going to work. So yeah, for people out there, they want to book these kind of things, don't bloat your invasion. Keep it simple, and make sure the guys who are invading are going to be on the same level as the guys who they're targeting.
Yeah, and let your heels get some heat.
Oh, definitely.
So,
which actually, letting your heels get some heat might be a great lesson for WWE to learn in general.
Yeah, they do. They have a, sometimes they're a little afraid to do that. There's no question about that.
It depends. I mean, they let Kane get heat, but Kane's been around for, 15 years? It's when it comes to giving, Dolph Ziggler heat on the problems. And that's why I guess Triple H coming off to be in charge eventually, if not sooner rather than later, might be a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a good possibility. It'd be interesting to see kind of what happens there. All right. Well, anything else you have to talk about here?
Not a whole lot. Just plugging the wrestling blog. I found that walls of Jericho Holic blogspot.com. Obviously, Fair to Flair, which is, it's where this is going to be released through. So if you're listening to this podcast, you're obviously aware of Fair to Flair. You can find me once a week at the Camel Clutch blog, which is camelclutchblog.com. Follow me on Twitter, at T. Holzerman. Like the wrestling blog on Facebook. Take care. Spike your... Wait, that's not my tagline. Sorry. yeah, you probably don't watch Zack Ryder's YouTube show then.
I do not, no. Sorry, I didn't mean to wreck your joke.
That's all right.
All right. I apologize. We could do it again. I could laugh the second time.
Nah, it's all right.
All right. Fair enough.
I won't ask you to be dishonest.
Okay. Yeah. I don't like to do that. So, yeah. Well, of course, keep checking out, as Tom mentioned, fairtoflair.com, also wrestlespective.com. We're going to keep doing these SummerSlam podcasts up until the day of the big event of SummerSlam 2011. So keep checking us out, and thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flair Quarterly from the writers of fairtoflair.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flair Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flair Quarterly today at fairtoflair.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.